More than just about anything else, what Democratic socialists seem to want is free government-run healthcare, what they call Medicare for All. And what they say is, lots of countries have something like that. That's just normal. Government-run healthcare, it's like having a library. Well, I don't know about that. How much would that cost? Can we really afford to have government-run healthcare in America? Do socialist systems actually work in the rest of the world like American socialists say they do? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors at Reason Magazine and some friends. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and a very special guest, Reason's very own Reem Ibrahim. Thank you for joining me, guys. Before we start, some big news on the podcast front. Reason Roundtable podcast is turning 10 years old this year. Old enough to drink and do drugs, at least.
And get a job.
So we're going to celebrate with a live show. Going to be in New York City in October, Wednesday, October 7th at the Village Underground. Whole podcast gang is going to be there. We're going to talk about the news and answer your questions. And you should be there too. Tickets, more details at reason.com/events. That is reason.com/events. We hope that you can make it. Now on to this week's show. Let's talk about Medicare for All and the cost of the DSA agenda. I want to frame this discussion. I want to start by playing a clip from the Joe Rogan Show, where Rogan and comedian Shane Gillis, great policy minds, this is how we do politics in America now, talk about healthcare.
We're calling everybody communist.
Yeah, socialist, communist.
And like, free healthcare is cool.
Yeah.
We should have that.
It's normal.
Yeah. That's not communism.
We should have health care and education.
Yeah.
You should treat the entire country like it's a community. If you have a community, would you want the sickest person to fucking die who could be very valuable if you could like take care of them? And do you have the resources to take care of them?
Of course you should. We're
take
a rich country.
Exactly.
You do it with libraries.
Exactly.
It's no big deal.
This is the problem with
capitalism.
We
don't feel like a community.
This is the reason why people turn on all these billionaires.
All right, Matt. What do you make of that?
That we don't take our cues from comedians on podcasts run by pot smoking MMA fighters or whatever. It's, you know, I remember my first beer too. Nobody really cared what I had to say that day. We're in an era where, and this is true of the DSA and the Dingbot podcast bro, right, as well, where it's, politics is much more performative, and it's more about, not even performative, but it's a consumption good. It's a way of kind of advertising what excites you politically and advertising that to everybody. And Medicare for All is just a really good bumper sticker and a really bad policy. And so people who don't need to, I mean, the more you treat politics as a consumption good, the less you actually care about how places are governed and how policies work out in the real world. Meanwhile, there is a real world, both in terms of what you can get done politically and how these different policies would look like in the real world. And as you've mentioned 1,000 times on this podcast, Peter, and rightly so, tried it in Vermont, didn't work, was too expensive. If we go to Medicare for All, if we actually tried to and successfully pass Medicare for All, which will never happen, if that happened, you'd have to make private health insurance illegal. You tell the hundreds of millions of Americans who have private health insurance or whatever through their company, place at work, that it's illegal. And that's just not going to go down at all. So, people talk about it like that. And those people don't make policy and they don't really care or deal with the ramifications of their bad policy bumper stickers as applied.
I got back from vacation this week and like the first thing that I had to do was email Jerry Tuchilli and be like, they're saying libraries are socialism. And if we accept libraries, we have to do Medicare for All. Please tell them why that's not true. Like that was like I brushed the sand off from the beach and sat down on my computer. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. This was in the Rogan clip. This is like a talking point now, I guess, that if you've ever checked out a library book, then you must like get immediately on the slip and slide of socialism and it's going to be a lovely and comfortable ride to the bottom.
Yeah, I think that
pure
comes from
insanity.
Zoran Mamdani, New York mayor, incepted this into our discourse.
No, it's been around forever. The if you go to the library, you are basically already a socialist thing has been lurking in the discourse. But Mamdani, I think, has elevated it, you know, for this round. And it's like quadruply annoying because it's so historically illiterate. Like, libraries were not a centrally planned phenomenon by the state in this way. They are not, like, the government does not own the means of library production. It's, sorry.
So what you're saying is we need, for those little free libraries, we need that, but for healthcare, little free healthcare?
Maybe. I guess it's like little free cyanide pills in the little free libraries for the death panels. I don't know. I don't know what the analogy is supposed to be, but it fails on every level.
Miriam, go ahead. But also, the thing I wanted to ask you about is this idea that it's normal countries have free healthcare. And you're from the UK. You know what it's like.
A normal country.
Is it normal? Does it work?
Well, it's certainly not normal. I think it's really interesting because everybody in the US that talks about universal healthcare or free healthcare or a single payer system just fails to look at the actual countries that have free healthcare at the point of use and what is actually going on in those systems. I mean, the UK has the second highest avoidable deaths in the Western world. Right. So this is, the outcomes are already pretty abysmal, but there are so many stories. If it just takes one Google search to hear about what's actually going on in a lot of these European countries, and the NHS is, you know, the perfect example of that. They used to say the NHS is like a religion in the UK. People absolutely adore it. They call it a sacred cow. But actually, there are recent polling that is now showing that people are starting to wake up to the fact that actually, waiting for hours and hours and hours in A&E when you've got something stuck out of your leg is not normal. Actually, waiting 6 months for supposedly emergency treatment is not normal. And, you know, I've got family experiences of this. My dad was supposed to get so-called emergency eye surgery because they said he was going to go blind. They did not give him the surgery. They said they just had no, you know, it's a supply issue. They had no people available to do it. And so after 6 months of waiting, he just went abroad and got the surgery elsewhere. And this is a story that is happening everywhere. I checked this morning, NHS waiting lists are now up to 7 million, and it's just basically stayed there, right? People are not accessing the healthcare they need. So yes, in theory, universal healthcare means that everybody gets free healthcare, but actually, you are still paying for it through taxpayer money, of course, but also it's not really free at the point of use if you can't even use it.
Right. So free healthcare ends up meaning lines. It ends up meaning that you got to wait for it, whether that means you've got to wait months to get, you know, an appointment with a cancer doctor, or whether that means you've got to wait hours, even days in a kind of emergency room setting, because as you said, you've got something sticking out of your leg. And the overflow valve in Canada is that they just come to the United States. I mean, but they do that elsewhere, but especially in Canada, they just come to the United States. But whenever we have this argument, Matt, people are like, well, look, the UK does have problems, but it's an especially bad system that is especially plagued by underfunding and bad bureaucratic management. We could just be Switzerland. We could just be Japan. We could even be France, which, as you know, you wrote a column about 15 years ago saying you preferred French healthcare, right? And so, like, steel man this for us a little bit, right? It works better in some of these.
The steel man case is Switzerland, much more than France. Switzerland, last time I checked, and I think it's probably still more or less the case, they make you, there's kind of a mandate to buy private insurance. And there's a government backstop to that, but they let market forces work out in that system a lot. They just make sure that everyone's in it. And it costs money. It's not free at the point of contact at all. It costs money, but you're also covered, and family members who live in Switzerland with recurring medical problems. And it's a mitzvah that they do because the quality is very, very, very good. But it's expensive. They pay money for it. In the case of France, more than Switzerland, it costs society more money. France is just an incredibly overtaxed country with stagnant economic growth for decades. And the generous social safety nets and early retirement is fundamentally a part of it. Whenever they try to change it even a tiny little bit, people start burning sheep on the streets. There's a couple of things that France does and other places do that we could also think about, which is that in France, one of the reasons why the consumer experience is so much more pleasant on a day-to-day basis, not necessarily if you have a really serious ailment, is because you can just walk to the pharmacy and the pharmacy can say, I think you should do this. And then you can get basically over-the-counter medication for the this pretty quickly. And there's no lines. It's literally your neighborhood pharmacist. I've done that many, many times over my lives, and it's very pleasant. We could do that by deregulating some of stuff that we do here. So just to root and branch, copy the French system, it's impossible to do in a country like America, and the trade-offs would be unbearable even if we did do it. Switzerland would be a more difficult thing because of constitutional reasons.
I like it the way that you brought that your tone of voice when you said it's impossible was like very French. You were like,
it's impossible.
It's not possible.
Catherine, so one thing about the French system is that the doctors get paid a lot less than they do here in the United States. And people say, well, look, you combine a universal benefit with lower wages for providers, and this helps kind of compress society economically. And that makes people happier because people don't like inequality. This is also an argument made for the Nordic system. And at the end of that clip from Rogan that we listened to, he talks about how this is why people hate billionaires. And is there maybe an argument, like from a libertarian perspective, that a universal healthcare benefit would make people hate billionaires a little bit less because they wouldn't feel like they're struggling so much to get the basics of life?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think that that's why people hate billionaires. I gave it a second, though. I was thinking about it because, on some level, you are right that the perceived inequality on its own is a real irritant for people, and I get that. I think that a broader based healthcare entitlement than the one we already have, because by the way, we do have healthcare entitlements for the elderly and the poor in this country already. I think that people
for the middle class, thanks to Obamacare.
Right. I think people would just take it for granted, and the complaints would just stack on top. I just think, this is the word entitlement in all of its meanings. Like it is a thing to which people would be entitled, and is a thing to which they would feel entitled. And I think we do see that around the world already. I think that the idea of remedying the sort of populist sentiment around sort of populist anti-billionaire sentiment with proposals that cost $200 trillion is probably not the way I would do it. Like, I would maybe consider, I don't know, like having a small political magazine that tries to do cultural change through suasion or something, and not spending $200 trillion, which I think is Cato's estimate of what this would cost.
Yes. I mean, it's the upper end of the estimate. I think it's really interesting what the Cato Institute's estimates on this stuff, because they were looking at how much of this would actually cost, but also how much of a proportion of public spending this would look like. And we're talking about, on the upper end, 92% of public spending being, 92% of GDP being public spending. And that is an absolutely astronomical amount of money that would require the mass confiscation of basically everything. You know, even if you took away all of the private businesses and all of the billionaires that you claim to hate, the left, then of course at the end of that you end up with an enormous amount of money being spent by the government. And the sort of spirit of private initiative in the US that does make America so special completely disappeared. So of course, this is not going to happen. And so I think that we shouldn't be taking the DSA's promises seriously at all, because there is no way anybody is going to accept what would be required for this. But I think the real crucial point here is that if we are to take anything that the DSA say seriously, then of course it would cost an enormous amount of money. But crucially, it is not just the billionaires that would have to pay for it. It is middle class people that would have to pay for all of these enormous spending measures. And this is not European style social democracy. This is Soviet communism. I mean, this is what the DSA website proposes. If you're talking about $212 trillion, that is not European social democracy. That is the mass confiscation of all private enterprise. And I think that that is obviously extraordinarily immoral, but crucially does not work in real life and will not help ordinary Americans.
And we're doing this in this conversation, but it happens in all the conversations about this where, you're sort of wobbling back and forth between like real honest to God socialism and like, well, couldn't we just, tweak our system to have a broader entitlement for some specific healthcare or something like that? And it, isn't it just libraries and also, the government owns the means of production? Like, it's everything is inside this conversation all the time. And so they're both sides, all sides do this sleight of hand, and it makes the conversation infuriating. Like, I realized just a second ago, you asked me, like, well, maybe we could pay doctors a little less. And that's like a real hardcore public policy question that we might make movement on. Like, oh, yeah, actually, if we broke the monopoly that that was currently in place on people entering the medical profession and just let a bunch of immigrant doctors and other people who want to enter the medical field without the same exact credential and years of practice enter the field, prices would come down. That would be nice. Like, we could increase
supply. Abolish occupational licensing and make it so that anybody can give you medical advice, or indeed with the stuff with the European system, you can just buy melatonin over the counter. You can't do that in America.
Actually, you can.
Oh, can you buy melatonin? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay.
And some of the other sleep aids that you can't. Yeah. Everybody on this podcast is like, oh, yeah, you can buy the sleep aids over the counter. We all know.
I got some in my bag.
There are other things that you can buy in Europe, but you can't buy in the U.S.
Right. That's absolutely true.
Just to clarify a little bit, that $200 trillion figure that we're talking about. Right. So that's a bunch of major policies from the Democratic Socialist agenda. That's not just Medicare for all, but even still, Medicare for all, basically all of the credible estimates show that it's going to cost $30 to $40 trillion in the form that Bernie Sanders has proposed over a decade. Right. And part of the thing, you know, what that Reem is pointing out here is that even the Bernie Sanders proposal, which is not necessarily the whole DSA kit and caboodle, it's much, much more generous than basically any other country in the world. So they're asking for like a program that doesn't exist elsewhere, and then saying, well, you know, they do it in the UK, they do it in Canada, they do it in Switzerland, they do it everywhere else. What Bernie Sanders wants to do with Medicare for all is not what they are doing in other countries. It's much, much more expensive. And again, so expensive that they couldn't do it in the Europe of the United States, Vermont. Matt, I want you to close us out here on this topic. Just by putting this in the context of the kind of overall fiscal situation, because last week, the Department of the Treasury reported on the budget for the fiscal year to date. It's not over. So this is just to date. U.S. deficit is now $1.8 trillion, larger than the deficit for all of last year. $1.2 trillion spent this fiscal year just on interest on the debt. And this is with 2 months still to go. So when we're talking about $200 trillion worth of stuff, or even just $30 to $40 trillion worth of stuff, this is just totally pie in the sky. This is not affordable in the context of the U.S. budget system as we have it right now.
Yeah, let's not sleep also on the $1.5 trillion or whatever it is these days to finance a Department of War that doesn't have weapons. Which is pretty a nifty accomplishment. We are headed for an entitlement slash fiscal cliff in 2030, 2031, 2032. And there isn't a single person in major party politics outside of Rand Paul that gives a rat's patootie about any of it. And so a lot of this bumper sticker politics is on the right and left in their own different ways. Is interesting. Let's talk about $20 burritos. Well, meanwhile, we're paying more interest on the debt than we are on military spending, which is unfathomable in this country. We're heading towards that moment. And we've seen this slow motion catastrophe for a really, really long time. And I think in a way that is completely discounted in the normal mainstream discourse and journalism about politics is that these calamities are now coming. They are manifest. They're in front of our faces. No one is preparing for it. And all it's going to take is a tiny little bit of some other calamity. Oh, we have a recession because the AI bubble burst. Oh, I don't know. There's some kind of foreign policy, complete unbundling of the Western world happening. Anything like that combined with that is going to lead to a politics that we currently haven't wrapped our heads around at all.
Well, I mean, the politics are already changing, and we see that with the rise of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, in the Democratic Party. And I think we should probably talk a little bit about what's happening there, because last week, noted Thanksgiving hater, Democratic Socialist Francesca Hong, lost, actually, in Wisconsin. She was running double digits ahead of her opponent, but moderate David Crowley eked out a narrow victory. What turned out to be a kind of a nail biter of a race. We didn't know until late the next morning who was going to win. So Hong was up, like I said, by double digits, widely favored to win. She was viewed in many ways as a test of what the DSA was capable of outside of its traditional stomping grounds, New York, the Commie Corridor. We talked about this a little bit on the pod last week. But Matt, combine this, sort of put this together here. What is going on here? We've got, she lost, but Dr. Abdul El-Sayed won, again, very narrowly, a Senate primary victory in Michigan the previous week. So what does that tell us about the limits of the DSA here?
I mean, I should point out, since we're, I think, on our fourth consecutive roundtable episode that begins with extended conversation about the DSA, that the number of DSA members currently in Congress is two.
It's going to be higher.
What's that?
It's going to be higher.
Yes, it's going to be perhaps as high as a half a dozen come fall. And, you know, Bernie Sanders is not a member.
That's a 300% increase or something.
He's the spiritual guy. Do you work for the Southern Poverty Law Center now?
I was going to say the Biden administration, but sure.
they're significant. I mean, the number of elected officials who are members of the DSA has increased from 35 in 2017 to something like 250 now. There's no doubt that this is where the juice is coming in the Democratic Party. And it's affecting people who, once sometimes sensible people like Ro Khanna is now just slinging the most incredible BS about policy, about taxing billionaires, like doing buybacks, stock buybacks for the wealth that we confiscate for someone. Just go and watch on Twitter and watch his arguments with Mark Cuban, including about Medicare for All. And it's just sort of remarkable to see. So they are exerting a pull on the Democratic Party. AOC, who is a member of the DSA and just all abbreviations from now on, did not endorse Francesca Hong or whatever you say her name is. She's a terrible candidate and she lost and it was a surprise. El-Sayed squeaked by in a swing state. And this is what, as we saw with the Tea Party, this is what sort of insurgent movements within a major party do. They exert pressure specifically in places where the general election candidate might lose. That's how you really show it. So it's an incredible dice roll when control of the Senate might be at stake on this one seat. And you're going to take someone who's pretty eminently beatable, but that's important enough to you because of what you care about for Medicare for All, but also for Israel. So I think all these things are kind of playing out amongst each other. And it's just it's remarkable that one of the responses to Donald Trump and the 10 years and 12 years of populism that we've seen is like, aha, how do we make the response even more unattractive than all of that? And so congratulations to us.
Well, it's even unattractive to some Democrats. I mean, part of what's interesting here is that there are Democrats who are separating themselves. Reem, over the weekend, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said he doesn't support the DSA agenda, gave this very tortured response about Medicare for All specifically, but he's like, DSA agenda, the $200 trillion package, that's not for me. Also, John Fetterman, a Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, tweeted, Democratic Party is becoming the party of socialism. I'm a proud free market capitalist, right? He wants to be the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, Catherine. But like, Reem, what do you make of this sort of distancing statement coming out of leadership in the Democratic Party, out of, you know, prominent senators?
Well, that's them wanting to get elected, right? I mean, that's them effectively saying that I am separating myself. Well, politicians wanting to get elected and keep their jobs? What? Yes, that is them trying to separate themselves from the DSA. And I think that it's interesting in this particular instance because the entire conversation about trying to tax billionaires and trying to make sure that all of those particular evil people are then having all of their money taken away. I mean, even the richest 400 Americans, in totality, if you take all of their businesses and all of their wealth, they total up to about $6.6 trillion, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what the DSA are promising. And I think that what's interesting is you always on the left, and especially within the Democratic Party, have this particular debate. And it's a sort of ideological battle for what it means to be a progressive. You know, does it mean that you want the world to be a better place and therefore that your goal to get there is slightly more conversations about policy? As Catherine mentioned, this idea that you might have a conversation about whether or not there is a trade-off to having doctors be paid less, but having, you know, more universal access. Those are genuine conversations being had. Or is it just a political punch bag using the billionaires or the very people you claim are evil? And I think, you're going to hate me for this, but I am going to quote Margaret Thatcher here. She said in her last speech as Prime Minister that the left would rather the poor were poorer so long as the rich were less rich. And I think that what's interesting about that particular sentence is that it encompasses this sort of idea that the left sort of view these people as pure evil, but actually it's not about making, you know, what actually makes people better off. Is it economic prosperity? Is it businesses being able to pay more people so then we have more jobs? Is it those kind of conversations about what actually help the people that are worse off? Actually, the conversation is always focused on those evil billionaires. And I think that these particular politicians are actually trying to distance themselves ever so slightly from that. But this is just, we're seeing the ideological battle for what it means to be a progressive. And I think that we're seeing two different sides of what that looks like.
Always quote Margaret Thatcher. More Margaret Thatcher quotes on this podcast, Catherine.
With the accent.
Yeah, obviously, right? Like, so sort of where do you fall on this? Matt's like, look, there's two DSA folks in Congress right now, and there might be four more. And Reem is pointing out that, yeah, okay, but they want to do some crazy stuff. It's $200 trillion worth of crazy stuff. How much of this, how big a threat do you view this as? Since I know you don't support these ideas.
What? How do you know that? Give me a chance to make my own argument. No, obviously I don't. I think I'm following it, and I've said this before, like I'm following it with just huge amounts of jealousy, right? I mean, I think this is the fringe elements in a major party who hold radical views are ascendant and are culturally interesting and seem to be having some electoral success. And will they take over that major party and have their way? And we had a go at this with the Tea Party and our point of view, and we screwed it up. Not just us, but everyone together. We worked together to screw it up. And it ended up just being government hands off my Medicare, and it was a big bummer. And then it morphed somehow into like the diehard MAGA loyalists of Trump's first term. So that didn't work out for us. I assume the same thing is going to happen with the ascendant DSA within the Democratic Party, that the party will ultimately treat these radicals as foreign bodies and figure out how to expel them while maybe looking like they're taking some of the ideas seriously. But if they are successful, we should be biting their style. We should be stealing their playbook, just like they stole ours and improved on it a little. Maybe the next iteration is libertarians take over the Republican Party. I am interested primarily for that reason. I do not think we're going to do socialism in America, but I think it is useful to freak out about it. I am happy to freak out about it because I think freaking out about it is part of why we won't do socialism in America. So
this episode of the Reason Roundtable is sponsored by BetterHelp. So you've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've ever actually talked about how much people love the service when they use it. You can check it out yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. The reviews are updated every day with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it has been to them. Please visit betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5, and that rating is based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself. More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally, and the consistent feedback from real users makes it easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. All right. We've got some more things to freak out about here. Let's talk a little bit about Trump changing America's military posture, because this weekend he said he would pull back from military exercises with South Korea. He pointed to his, and this is a quote, very good relationship. Very good relationship with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So that's why we're not doing joint military exercises with South Korea anymore. Matt, what do you think about this? And especially given some of the other moves Trump has made, he pulled troops from Germany. There's this ongoing effort by the Pentagon to review America's military presence in Europe. Like, in some ways, isn't this what libertarians want, to kind of pull back from the international stage militarily? But also, whenever we say stuff like that, people are like, like critics are like, yeah, so what you effectively want is to turn a lot of power over to a bunch of autocrats and dictators. And it kind of sounds like when Donald Trump is saying, no, but this is what people, yes, when we say we've got to pull back from the international stage, like I hear this, it's like that empowers Putin, right? When we're like, we got to pull back from the South Seas, that empowers China or North Korea. And Trump is here saying he's doing this because he's cozy with the guy who runs North Korea.
He's also doing it because he's miffed that South Korea isn't being more active in the Strait of Hormuz, because there's a problem in the Strait of Hormuz that Donald Trump caused in late February of this year. It's still ongoing, still really bad, and he's not getting any help from other allied countries, partly because other allied countries don't want to help him. Because it's a really stupid idea what he did. And also he's been treating them like garbage for a really long time. You know, I never want to say what libertarians want when talking about foreign policy because reasons.
Because you were only the editor-in-chief of a libertarian public policy magazine for 8 years or so. So
my views might
speak for what libertarians.
I think that... it's right and good to be assessing your worldwide troop deployments. I think that we shouldn't have as many troops in South Korea and Germany. I agree with the president here, but that's not what the president did. It wasn't like, hey, this is a well-considered, you know, let's talk in advance. It's right before we do an exercise. I'm going to do a truth social talking about how you're not helping us enough in Strait of Hormuz. And I'm very close with Kim Jong-un, not really mentioning that Kim Jong-un is sending weapons and soldiers to European soil in a war of aggression against a friendly state with whom we are not, Article 5 allied, but we are allied. North Korea, which points missiles at South Korea constantly. This is not how you do it. This is not how you engage in those thoughtful recalibrations of foreign policy. And you're already seeing belatedly in Europe, I think it was just a couple of days ago, one of the Polish foreign minister, I think it was talking about having a European-only defense force in which Ukraine could be part of. That's the future because Trump has been blowing this up. Instead of having a thoughtful, hey, let's retransfer authority so that Europe is in charge of Europe, and we'll be friendly, but we will have less of a role. He acts erratically on narcissistic personal whims, and that creates more instability than smart policy.
Hey, Catherine, at least we're saving money, right? Like the defense budget, it's going down. Yeah?
Wrong. Yeah. I mean, do you know how many troops there are, American troops in South Korea right now?
26,000.
28,500. It's so many. Yeah. So many. Like I think people who follow kind of this broad-based debate about kind of semi-permanent or permanent American outposts abroad and the ramifications of that. I think I felt like, I was aware of that there's this huge presence in Germany, which has always felt just utterly insane to me. But I did not have this number in my mind. If you had asked me, I would have said a lower number. And I think that this is why we keep coming back for more Donald Trump, because it actually is a reasonable point to be like, wait, why are there 30,000 Americans just like hanging out defending South Korea? And like, we have a fight periodically about who exactly is paying what for those troops to be there. But they are still just like American soldiers deployed abroad, mostly the army, in South Korea. And I think, of course, this is an utterly bonkers way to make that point, and also a politically motivated and personally motivated way, timing for executing it. But the underlying point is correct, that it is in a world of constrained resources. This is a deeply odd use of our resources.
And it's not just South Korea. I mean, it's not just South Korea or Germany, right? There are so many countries. Yeah. It literally is everywhere. I mean, I could walk into any bar in Europe and I would find some Americans that are like, oh, I've got 2 days off. I remember being in Athens going on a bar crawl, and that everybody there was in the American military. everyone. I mean, there were so many of them. And I was so surprised, like, oh yeah, we're out of here for another 6 months. Why? That does seem like an enormous waste of money. And so I do think that, you know, to the extent that Trump wants to reduce the amount of spending abroad, which I don't believe for a second, but if that is the case, then absolutely, this is a really good way of reducing that. And actually, there is so much more that could be done. However, I am really, really concerned, and Matt mentioned this, I'm really concerned by Trump's quote-unquote very good relationship with Kim Jong-un, especially because it's not just normal warheads, nuclear warheads. Kim Jong-un is sending to Russia. They are helping, actively helping with troops, Russia fight Ukraine in this invasion of another sovereign country. And I think that that entire conversation, saying that South Korea need to be punished because they did not help Trump in Iran, I think is outrageous. And by the way, I think that this is a broader thing that Trump is doing internationally, where if a country does not do what he wants, he will bully them into submission. And he tried this with Greenland. He tried this with so many other situations in which if Trump feels as though another country is like disrespecting him because they don't want to spend their own money on this really stupid war, then he will try and do something to punish them. And that is a really bad way of doing foreign policy.
Yeah, it's one thing to ask other countries to pitch in to pay for their own real defense. It's another thing to get mad at them when they don't support your stupid war that closed the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe. Catherine, is it open this week?
Screw you, Peter.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to our listener question of the week. A reminder, we really enjoy answering your questions, and we've gotten a lot of great ones recently, so thank you to everyone who has been emailing. If you want us to answer your question, please email your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long query to podcast@reason.com. That is podcast@reason.com, and thank you, as always, for putting the words listener question in the subject line. This week's listener question comes from TJ, who writes, I'm a high school teacher and a weekly listener. I truly love to hear you all discuss policy and politics. Thanks, DJ. I always hear you all discussing current or future policy and how it affects the country and its people, which I know is the point of the podcast. But I was wondering if each of you could answer this question. When, in each of your own lifetimes, has the government been most effective and worked best for the people? So, for example, specific policies, laws, bills, executive orders, Supreme Court judgments, and so forth. Catherine, I want to start with you. You are an anarchist. So what's your favorite government policy? When did it work really well for you?
I took this question very seriously and I gave it some real thought. Like, what is an answer that will hurt me to give? Because it's not fair if the answer you give is like the time that we deregulated some stuff. I don't actually think that is what this question answer is asking. And I am forced, and truly this hurts me, to grudgingly say that I think maybe the 1990 Clean Air Act was okay in terms
of...
Wait,
what?
I know. Okay, so let me explain.
Reporting you immediately to the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
I am not saying this is my preferred way of handling the difficult problem of negative externalities from pollution, but it was a bill that was done the way bills are supposed to be done. First of all, like the process on it was legit. It was like a single thing. It was debated. There was compromise. It was done, you know, and it was solving a specific problem. This was like peak acid rain panic. So it was like, okay, we specifically need to solve the problem of sulfur dioxide. What are we going to do? And it was a tradable permit scheme. So we still have the problem that the government just arbitrarily said, here's how much sulfur dioxide can be in the world. And that sucks. And that's bad. And we shouldn't do that that way. But it seems like they ish kind of got the number okay, or at least close enough by an order of magnitude. And they built a tradable permit scheme that ish kind of worked and acted a little bit like a market. And we don't have acid rain anymore.
Sounds pretty woke to me.
And like, I also think this probably would have happened anyway because we were already moving in this direction, all these things. But process-wise, it was pretty clean. It was like a solution that took into account the realities of economics, and it did solve the problem it set out to solve. And it was 1990, so that is squarely within my lifetime. This was just as painful for me as it was for you guys, and we can just never speak of it again.
It is pretty crazy that back in the 80s and 90s, they used to put MDMA in the rain. All right, it's acid rain. It's acid rain. Come on, it's a joke.
LSD, you are the worst libertarian ever.
Jesus Christ, dude.
Did people just stand outside with their mouths open?
No, it was so sad. All the statues were just being eroded away. All my school textbooks were very panicked about that.
How sad. Well, this question as a Brit, I think, is really interesting because obviously in my lifetime, I mean, I've lived in the United States for less than a year. It's been 6 months, right? So for me, listening to everything that's gone on in the US and seeing exactly what is, you know, what do international folk or at least libertarians abroad, like, what are they envious of in the United States? And I think it's undoubtedly the institution of the Supreme Court and the interpretations around the First Amendment. So I noted down some examples. I actually think that, like, IEEPA tariffs earlier this year was really interesting because it was a really great example of the Supreme Court actually constraining the power of the executive. But also on the First Amendment, I mean, the NRA being defended because they're being restricted by federal regulators who are trying to suppress their pro-gun advocacy. There are so many examples of this happening in my lifetime in which the Supreme Court has, for the most part, acted in favor of the First Amendment and in favor of the Americans' right to freely express themselves. And I think that that is, from my perspective, something that, or the predominant thing that libertarians internationally are envious of. People are envious of the Supreme Court and envious of the First Amendment. And I actually think that even in the current day and age in which the Supreme Court justices are often politically appointed in some ways, I actually still think that the best part of the American government that works in favor for the people is the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, we have actually a great Jacob Sullum piece on the website this morning about the many ways that Donald Trump has tried to expand executive power, basically say it's not reviewable by the Supreme Court, and then the court stepping in and saying, nope, it is, we're going to stop you. It's a pretty good piece. And the court's pretty good. Matt Welch.
In the 4 hours since I first read this email, I haven't been able to come up to my satisfaction and create a metric by which I could measure what's the most effective use of government in my lifetime. So I'll point to one that wasn't in my lifetime, which is, I think, an underrated moment between 1945 and 1947 when Harry Truman did a couple of things. The first is had to figure out what to do with all these damn soldiers. We had 10 million men in uniform. What to do? All this federal government was spending $93 billion a year. That's a lot of money back then. And there was a lot of pressure by the Keynesians amongst people whispering into government ears saying, well, you got to keep them employed and otherwise dealt with. And Harry Truman cut government from $93 billion to $36 billion. The workforce suddenly got flooded with 7 million new people. Some of the returning military went and used the GI Bill and got themselves educated. But this was kind of a radical move that we don't really spend a lot of time talking about. Arnold Kling wrote about it for us in that issue of the magazine with Catherine's Terrifying Hands. And it's an important lesson. And meanwhile, at the exact same time, Harry Truman, in a span of about 43 months, was helping create the Marshall Plan, GATT, the first sort of precursor to the WTO, the United Nations. Maybe we don't love everything, single thing, part of it about this world building, but basically creating the post-war America-led order as it stands, while engaging in radical decommissioning of a cranked up federal government, and was rewarded with economic growth and being the envy of the world, not just for First Amendment jurisprudence, but also just kind of kicking ass and being on the right side of the Cold War. So I think that deserves a little shout out, Harry S.
Yeah, it's been mentioned, but my favorite thing the government does is protect the right to say what you think about the government. And in the United States, we have that right more than just about anywhere else on the planet, thanks to the First Amendment. I've been thinking a lot about this recently, actually, just because of the Jason Arday story. And part of that story that we talked about on this podcast was that Arday hired a law firm and then called the police on a journalist who was trying to expose that he was a plagiarist and a liar. And so he is tragically and sadly passed away since we last talked about him. But that story really just drives home how even in the UK, even in, you know, the Western world, people just don't have the freedom to speak their minds. People are being arrested for tweets. Fire has counts of this, and it's just crazy. In the United States, that doesn't happen. We've got a lot of problems here, but the First Amendment means that people like us can do our jobs without without the fear that we're going to go to jail. Thank you to TJ.
You know who has done her job in this segment and no one else? Me. I feel like I interpreted this question correctly and all of the rest of you were cowards and you were just like, good things are good and nice things are nice.
United Nations. I took one for
that's
the team.
True. But you did not answer the question. So there is that.
That's whatever.
But the First Amendment is protecting me, right? Protecting all of us right now. It's seriously.
It's
like,
only
I
can protect
just,
you so much,
Superman. It's like a good thing. Protecting. Yeah. Okay. It's not protecting me from you. But that's, you know, 500 miles of distance here.
I will say, I think that there is a rose-tinted view of the First Amendment and how powerful it really is in the US. And I do think that I had this perspective before I moved here. But of course, there are lots of situations in which the federal government does violate the First Amendment and nothing's done about it. I mean, there are people, there was the student that wrote that pro-Palestine op-ed and she was arrested and they use immigration law enforcement to try and suppress speech. ICE have gone into like American citizens' workplaces and said, hey, you guys should take down this Instagram post. This happened with a woman in Syracuse. I do think that I absolutely love the First Amendment and it's brilliant. And America is absolutely, I think, one of the best places in the world for free speech. But that doesn't mean we should just rest easy because there are situations in which the federal government does ignore the First Amendment and does violate people's rights to freely express themselves.
Yeah, I mean, one under appreciated or under commented on aspect of Trump's immigration crackdown is the free speech aspect of it, right? It's not just that they're going after people, it's that they're going after what people are saying. And it's bad. Let's move on to another topic that seems like a little bit of a thematically appropriate follow-up since TJ is a teacher. And this segment is about kids playing outside. Catherine, you're a mother. You're also an anarchist. Should children playing outside be a crime?
This one isn't easy. This is the kind of question I like on this podcast. No, that stuff should be legal, man. And of course, our very own Lenore Skenazy, who has been writing for us for ages and ages on this topic, was written up recently in the New York Times for being in this fight. And I think it is so important. I think this is the kind of thing that you have to be doing if you have any hope for the future of American anything, including politics. You know, kids need to be unsupervised sometimes. They need to be minimally supervised a lot more because then they can grow up to be adults who are comfortable being unsupervised, which is what we should all want to be, just unsupervised by, I don't know, Hakeem Jeffries.
Unsupervised is exactly how things work at Reason, for better and for worse, which you have been experiencing, Reem, since you just started here within the last year, right? And you came from the UK. So I sort of wanted you to sort of help us understand, like, is this a thing that happens in Europe? Do they arrest parents for letting 10-year-olds go pick up groceries or, you know, walk across the street, play at the playground by themselves?
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, the police absolutely love arresting people for no reason, including tweets, but of course, including parents. This does happen in Europe. I will say there is a bit more of a cultural relaxation aspect when it comes to parenting. I mean, for example, in the UK, children are allowed to drink alcohol from the age of 5. Like, you're allowed to have a sip of alcohol at the age of 5 because there is an understanding that parents are going to let their kids do it anyway and they can just make those decisions themselves. You can't legally purchase alcohol till you're 18. Again, another thing that Europe is freer on than America. But I do think that when it comes to parenting, there is this really interesting desire to wrap children in cotton wool and protect them from all of these harms. And I do think true crime documentaries have fueled all of this because everybody is so afraid of their children being kidnapped, or you know, there is this heightened sense of urgency that, you know, there is more and more kidnappings happening all the time. Actually, most kidnappings happen from people that already know the kid. It's often like the estranged father or, you know, an uncle. It's normally people that you already have relationships with that child. The stranger kidnapping thing doesn't really happen at all. I think that the Times article said that it was about 100 a year, which is way, way less than what people perceive it to be. People think it's like 50,000 a year. And I do think that children, generally speaking, should have the right to explore their individual independence. And I think that they grow up to be well-adjusted, well-rounded adults as a result of it. I will say from my personal experience, I grew up in a very sort of controlled household in which we weren't allowed to do very much. And I think that that does have a hindrance on whether or not you're able to gain that independence as a teenager. So, I mean, I think that this is a cultural thing that has led to the government getting into, you know, intervening in this stuff. The Times article showed this woman who had her son walk to the shops and or play outside, and he was 6 years old, and the police officer seemed to propagate her personal opinions on what was right and wrong rather than this being a law. So I think Americans need to stop being so uptight. Let your kids chill.
No one wants your children. It's so important to keep that in mind.
My wife grew up in New York in the 1970s and talks about running to the local store past like all of the drug dealers and the sex workers on the streets that she didn't really know what they were doing, but they were just sort of right there. It was the Upper West Side, Manhattan in the 1970s. And she would buy cigarettes for her mom. And like, this was a thing that she had to do all the time. It was just like, this was understood that this is what your 8-year-old children are for, is to go buy you cigarettes on, you know, next to the, you know, on the sex worker street. But then something changed, right, Matt? And this is, I mean, so the Times story, actually, the reason we're talking about this is because of the recent New York Times story. But this has been something that has been in the works for, you know, 40 years or so, right? And the Times kind of pins this down to a case of a 6-year-old who disappeared in 1979. And then, a media panic about this. And then Congress picking up on that media panic and passing the Missing Children Act in 1982. And then after that, there were all of these milk cartons. We all remember this. Maybe Reem doesn't. Yep. Right. But it was the milk cartons with the pictures of the missing children on them. And everybody got it in their head that stranger danger was this real thing, that you had to be absolutely terrified for your children at all times. And it turns out that's not really true.
And meanwhile, there's, I think also importantly, the difference between my childhood and childhood nowadays of my kids. Numbers are completely different. I grew up in a family of 4 kids. My block growing up, a bunch of GI Bill people buying tract housing in the suburbs. There were like 75 kids on my block. I mean, you just couldn't drive a car down the street that the cars were supposed to go down because the kids are playing football and hockey and baseball and a bunch of other stuff besides. There's a scarcity now. So it's really interesting. I think Reem's absolutely right to say that it comes in the culture first and then government is sort of second. Afterwards, you know, you can be someone like I am who I look back on my childhood fondly and it was absolutely free range. They had no idea where we were for 15 years. And then I went to college. And I want that for my kids. But I live in a society, Catherine, and it's pretty damn difficult. And this is a lot of the tension that Lenore writes about constantly, and a lot of the work that that she has done with Jonathan Haidt and other people is like, how do you build those muscles? Because all of society is going into the opposite direction, especially in a neurotic place like New York City where I live. And it's not easy. It is really, really not easy to have your just 2 kids instead of the 4. The society around you is, you know, maybe not scared about milk cartons so much, but everything is just sort of protected, managed. I have an 18-year-old literally yesterday. She turned 18 last month, but literally yesterday I had the conversation with her eliciting a shriek in which I said, okay, right now, today, outside of Sephora, that is the last time I'm buying one of your friends a birthday present. It was like, eek! And everyone else should be shrieking at me because I let it go this far. It's really, really difficult, even with kids who've had a job, like my 18-year-old had a couple of jobs, like to teach self-sufficiency in an era where everything culturally goes in the opposite directions. It's a challenge. And I hope that we get out of it. But I'm worried because I think the demographics are making us even take our 1.2 children now and treat them like little precious diamonds instead of just flinging them out onto the hooker filled streets of the West Side.
All right, let's get out of this segment, move on to our cultural recommendations. Books, movies, television, museum, music, other cultural whatnot that we recommend or perhaps don't. Reem, have you been experiencing America? And you want to tell us about it?
I have been experiencing America. I've got to say, I feel like the last month I've just been doing different American things. This weekend I'm going tubing for the first time. That's going to be great. But my cultural recommendation...
Do they not have tubes in the UK?
It's not a thing. People don't do that. This is a purely American thing, and I'm experiencing Americana.
I gotta tell you, my dude, sunscreen.
Especially whack it on.
Brits.
On the tops of your knees. Everybody goes tubing for the first time and then has to buy aloe. So just give it a...
Also, you need a separate tube just for your beer.
Yes, that is the plan. The plan is to get...
Tube for the beer, clearly. That goes without saying.
That is the priority, really. Priority drinking, maybe sunscreen second. The thing I did on Saturday, though, which I absolutely do recommend, is the Montgomery Agricultural Fair. And I think that, so first of all, awesome. Like, the food is awesome. Fried dough signs everywhere. I had Reese's flavored funnel cake. That was really cool. I also saw pigs race. That was cool. It was just, everything was amazing. But the reason why I thought I'd recommend it today is because there is a bit of a reason you take it. I was speaking to the guy that was doing photography, he was one of the guys that works at the fair, and he was explaining that actually the sort of animal section, the agricultural section, is funded in part by the commercial rides and the fun fried dough. All of that is funding and, I suppose, in some ways subsidizing the sort of more educational aspect that doesn't really make any money. And I thought that that was really interesting. Now, no doubt they probably also get a whole bunch of like government subsidies. But I do think it's really interesting because this is a purely American thing where you've got cultural fairs that are, for the most part, self-sufficient, and they are recognizing the fact that this part makes money, this part doesn't make money, but that's okay. We can still have cool animals. We can have libraries. We can have cool things, and it doesn't have to be purely funded by the taxpayer. And I just smiled knowing that the money I was spending on my Reese's funnel cake was probably going to teach a child where an egg comes from.
The fried dough subsidy. I can't. A Reese's funnel cake, really?
That sounds nasty.
No, it was
I love
really
funnel
good.
Cakes and I love Reese's and I am not sure I want them together.
It was really good.
I'm a purist on the funnel cake, but I will defend to the death Reem's right to put Thanks, Reese's on her.
So, do we call them fried the dough funnel cakes? Cake. Fried dough, funnel cakes, or elephant ears? Everybody go. Matt.
Funnel cake, obviously. What do we I think what do you mean?
Cake. Funnel cake. Come on.
Roll
what do you
funnel
call
cake
it?
On
what
this
do you
podcast.
Call it?
It's an elephant ear.
That's crazy.
Called an elephant ear.
Where the hell are you from?
I think we went to different fairs growing up. Do you have a cultural recommendation for us? Kathy?
I do, and it's so good, you guys. Okay. Reasons, listeners, the Reason Roundtable listeners in particular are fantastic, and they frequently send suggestions my way of things to consume, but Adir Zaghouri has beaten all of y'all. He wrote a whole book, and he sent it to me. And I was like, thanks, dude. I'll put that on my Kindle and probably not read it. But then I ran out of books. And so I was like, I'll check out this dude's book. It's called Dealing in Shadows. It is a fantasy novel and it is good. You can get it on Amazon. Dealing in Shadows by Adir Zaghouri. And it's a fantasy novel that's just a regular D&D-ish fantasy novel. But our hero is a merchant operating outside of the law. And he joins, without too many spoilers, he joins a revolution, but then, because the king is bad, but then maybe the revolution's bad too? And what will he learn in the end? Maybe the real hero is the trade we made along the way. It's so libertarian, but not in an annoying way. He has like a whole religious system where the god Auspicious is like the relevant deity for the merchants.
That's the god's name?
Yeah. It's really good. And you have to like contracts are like lightly backed by kind of a spiritual belief in their importance. There is magic. The magic, like the nobles have certain gifts, but they can sell the gifts to the merchants. And then everyone that's kind of controversial and our hero trades in some of those gifts. Guys, truly a delightful little fantasy novel. And just it's the spirit is the same as the spirit of Firefly. It's got the same energy as what if. Your hero was the guy performing trades who is skeptical of the state, but maybe also skeptical of the proposed violent remedies to the state. Is there a big battle scene in the middle that lasts too long for my taste? Yes. Is that true of every single fantasy novel, television show, and movie from my perspective, except for the Battle of Helm's Deep? Also, yes. So, buyer beware, if you don't want a big, long battle scene with lots of, you know, peril and stuff, that is in there. But most of it is trade. Dealing in shadows.
For a second there, I thought you said that all the nobles had magic gifts, like the little animations that you posted in replies on Twitter. And I want somebody to write that fantasy novel now. Is there a good comp for this? Like, if you like X, you'll like this?
It's very D&D-ish. It's extremely D&D-ish. It's got Wheel of Time kind of feel to it. It's got, you know, it's just, we're on an adventure with our hero, Carter, except for instead of being a special boy who is magic or, a sort of Campbell-style hero's journey, he's just trying to make money and do interesting stuff and live in peace. And he has a good heart and he keeps falling in with people who want to force other people to do things.
People like the musician I'm going to talk about. Let's continue our journey here with my recommendation is Phoebe Bridgers' new record, Lost Weekend. So this is her third full-length solo album, her first solo album since 2020. And it is very, very good. It's dreamy and it's sad. And it's also just got like this great energy to it. I mean, even kind of an anger at times, but also a kind of angst to it. Right. I saw a review on social media actually posted by one of our colleagues, Eric Bame, that said, this album is really layered. It's like a depressed lasagna. And that was meant as a compliment. And like, this is right. It's a depressed lasagna. It's one of the best albums I've heard in the last couple of years. And it's from an artist I actually really don't agree with on a lot of things politically. So Bridgers, if you don't know anything about her, right, she started out about a decade ago as this kind of wispy indie folk singer. And the last couple of years, since 2020 in particular, she has become a full-blown pop star. Won Grammys. She has performed as part of this sort of lady indie folk supergroup with Lucy Dacus and Julian Baker called Boy Genius. She opened for Taylor Swift on the Eras Tour, which even second fiddle to Taylor Swift is like the biggest possible fiddle other than Taylor Swift. And she's touring again this year. She's playing shows that are people are getting kind of annoyed because there is a very strict no phones policy. Like they're collecting them at the door and she's like, you can't record anything. Right. So she's just sort of engages like she draws controversy, though. And because it's not just the phones thing. She's very politically outspoken, very much on the left. Just to give you an idea of how much that's part of her persona. If you go to her Wikipedia page, you will find like a whole big section that's just on her political activism, right? It's like life, controversies, death. But like for her, it's, you know, life, music, political activism, and then whatever comes after that, right? And, you know, her politics, not where I'm at. But I want to make the case for engaging with art and artists outside of their political views if you can, because if you get to enjoy spectacular albums like this, this absolutely gorgeous, moody vision of depressed lasagna. I kind of loved it, highly recommend it. One of the best albums, like I said, that I have heard in a very long time. Matt, do you have any good TV for us that you want to recommend?
Yeah, so I watched in its entirety Widow's Bay. Surprise hit, critically acclaimed Apple TV production in which Matthew Rhys, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, which I'm
not. It's actually Matthew Rhys. I discovered this only a few months ago, actually, while doing some stuff about Widow's Bay.
It's the Welsh that cannot ever be trusted.
He's extremely Welsh.
Yeah.
He's like a professional Welshman.
He plays a mayor of a small, sad-ish island in New England that he's sort of harried and he wants to become the Martha's Vineyard of whatever patch of water that they're in. And I'm pretty sure that Peter actually lives there, and it explains a lot about his personality.
Pretty close. But the show was shot about 40 minutes from me.
So he wants to bring tourism and get a New York Times writer talk about the island. But the thing is, the island has kind of a creepy past and perhaps even present. And so it's a sort of comedy horror as the way it's described. And for those of you out there who don't like horror movies, who don't like even being in the theater when the previews of the horror movies come on and you get mad and you like hide your face and you maybe just like punch someone next to you, this is an acceptable horror for you because it's comedy horror. There's not like a bunch of jump cuts and screams and weak, weak, weak kind of stuff. The island has a dark secret. The mayor is making moral compromises. In the name of like trying to get beyond all these superstitions. And then we see that maybe, it leads him to some really, stark, and terrible choices. But it's mostly just kind of a light thing to watch. 10 episodes. I don't really know how they're going to do the season 2. I predict pain in terms of trying to keep that one going. But for a 10-episode run, pretty just digestible and kind of fun and interesting and some good good characters and a little bit of food for thought. So Widow's Bay, check it out.
Well, the way they're going to get a second season is that once you get through the show and start seeing how it's structured, at first it feels like it's going to be one of these kind of single story series. And then it turns out it's basically just the X-Files, right, Catherine? Like you watch the X-Files, right?
Watch the X-Files. Of course I watched the X-Files. Who do you take me for?
And they had some mythology episodes, but a lot of the episodes were what they called Monster of the Week episodes. And this turns out to be basically a Monster of the Week show. There's the Scary Clown episode. There's the Serial Killer episode. There's the Sea Hag episode, Catherine. Yeah.
Are these spoilers?
So many these more monsters like that they could have every episode in the next season. The comic DNA here of the show, I love it because the woman who created it comes first from Mad Television. If you guys remember the SNL kind of ripoff that like we watched, but I think no one else did. And then she wrote for Parks and Recreation. And this show has so much Parks and Recreation DNA. It is about the kind of the sort of weird, awkward comedy of trying to run an extremely local government. And Matthew Rhys is like doing some mayor stuff, but mostly what he's doing is trying to play development executive, like tourist, like build the sort of tourist economy, right? And like thinking of that as his primary job. And it's just fantastic. It's maybe my favorite new show like since the pandemic. But yeah, good recommendation. All right, folks, that is our show for this week. If you like what we do at Reason, if you like the Reason Roundtable, which is having its 10th anniversary podcast in New York in October, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That is reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you for joining us, Reem. Reason Roundtable will return.